Welcome to the ninth message of our series, Live in Grace, which is part two of our study of the life of David. Keep watching as we see how David, who had been such a brave warrior in attacking enemies, even giants like Goliath on the battlefield, was a coward and a wimp who avoided dealing with threats to his family. We will see how, from his example and from other biblical teaching, that avoiding an issue never makes it better. It instead lets the problem grow and spread, bringing even greater pain and destruction to our lives. When I was about 10 years old, I remember I was playing with the family dog on the floor, and a ball rolled underneath the sofa, and I reached down to get it, and as I pulled it back, I felt and heard a rip because there was a nail underneath that I caught my wrist on. And there was suddenly a large gash on my wrist, about 2 inches. It was so deep you could see bone. I mean, it was just a terrible cut. And for whatever reason, and I don't know why, I can't explain it, I felt stupid about my cut. And I felt it was something that I had reason to be ashamed of, and I didn't want to tell anybody. And part of it might have been, too, that I was kind of afraid of getting it treated and stitches, and I wanted to avoid the pain. But what I decided to do is to use the vast medical knowledge I had as a 10-year-old and to treat myself. So I remember going upstairs, and I rinsed it out in the water, and it was bleeding all over, so I put gauze on it to try to slow down the bleeding, and I knew that I should do some antiseptic, so I found this like spray antiseptic, and I sprayed it on there, and it was way too big for a Band-Aid. So I remember getting gauze and kind of wrapping it around my wrist, so that it, was all wrapped up. And I remember, you might be thinking, what a medical genius at 10 years old. And, it's like, wow. And you might not be thinking that, but I was at that time. Like, I've got this down. And I remember it was dinner time. My mom saw, me, and I've got gauze wrapped around my arm. And she's like, what happened? I said, oh, I got a cut. And she probably thought it was the overreaction of a child and didn't think much of it. Well, finally, the next day, she saw it still wrapped up, and she said, well, I've got to see that cut. And I take it off, and she just about passed out, again, this huge cut, you could see the bone, and within the hour, I'm at the emergency room getting it treated. And unfortunately, it ended up becoming a very complicated treatment because I had waited too long. And because it had been exposed that long, they couldn't, even with cleaning it out, they couldn't put stitches on it. It ended up being a very, very complicated treatment where it almost was like I had a broken hand for a matter of months because of what I couldn't do and how I had to deal with it. I thought that if I could just ignore the problem, I could make it better. I thought that, boy, if I put it with gauze and I couldn't see it and dirt couldn't get in, then somehow it would make itself better. But the reality was that the longer that I left it untreated, the more that it became infected, and actually the more complicated the problem became, and it actually then risked an infection that would not only risk my hand, but actually risk my whole body. And this story illustrates a basic medical truth. Physical wound never gets better by covering it up and ignoring it. It needs to be exposed. It needs to be treated. And ignoring a serious wound only leads to infection, which in time will not only make the problem worse, but has the potential of spreading and causing damage to our whole body. Now, let me ask a question. See, this is a concept that we readily understand and accept when it comes to physical wounds and to medical understanding. But why is it that we often fail to accept and embrace this idea when it comes to issues of emotional wounds or spiritual wounds or relational wounds? You see, because the same principle is true. When we have these kind of wounds, if we leave them untreated, what happens in the same way, it doesn't get better, but instead it actually becomes infected. And the more that we leave it alone, it becomes infected to the point where it not only impacts that one relationship or that one situation where it started, but it begins to impact our whole being, our emotions, and all the relationships with all the people that we interact with. Now, this morning, we're going to look at 2 Samuel 13 and 14, and what we see is that the Bible here is really warning us against three kind of wounds that we regularly, for whatever reason, feel ashamed of, feel afraid of, and we try to cover up. We don't deal with them. We take the approach of the 10-year-old boy of covering it up and thinking that if we cover it with some kind of spiritual gauze and we don't see it and we can hide it from some kind of dirt, then it's going to make it better. But the reality is, we're going to see in David's life, and we see a spiritual truth, that any of these things, if we leave untreated, they don't get better. But what happens is over time, they become, in a sense, infected, and it becomes worse, and it becomes more difficult to deal with, and it impacts, again, not just us, but it impacts, over time, all of our relationships. Now, the first wound that we see that we naturally tend to overlook is and hide is the danger of dealing with past abuse or emotional wounds. And this is illustrated by a story that we began to look at last week, and that's the story of Tamar. If you were with us last week, you know this. If you weren't, you can go back and read all of chapter 13. And the first part really tells the story about one of David's sons. He had multiple wives, and so you have one son who looks at his half-sister, Tamar, and has this incredible lust for her and acts on that with eventually raping her. And so you have this sexual assault, and it's a terrible event. And what happens is immediately after that, he rejects her, and you see her response. Look at verse 18. She was wearing this long robe with sleeves, for thus were the virgin daughters of the king dressed. So his servant put her out and bolted the door after her, and Tamar put ashes on her head and tore the long robe that she wore, and she laid her hand upon her head and went away crying aloud as she went. And so her first response is public grieving, but then look at the advice that she's given by her brother, the one who's looking out for. Verse 20, and her brother Absalom said to her, "Has Amnon your brother been with you? Now hold your peace, my sister. He is your brother. Do not take this to heart." Now the weight of his advice is basically this. You know, he's your brother. You don't want to cause problems for the family, do you? Not only that, well, remember, he's the child of the king. He's literally the crown prince. You know, how can you bring such an accusation against the crown prince? And what frustrates me, there's several things when I look at this, it really just frustrates me, knowing from my experience of working with people, how often people are told basically the same thing. People that are victims of abuse today, that they're pressured into staying silent. Oh, you can't bring that accusation. Oh, you can't do that. Nobody's going to believe you. Or, you can't do that. Boy, it's going to cause such problem for that person or for this family member. And so we're pressured to say the same thing. And often what you have is victims that are now pressured to somehow protect the abuser or the institution that was involved, the family. But in reality, what happens is that the victim then is pressured to hide or to ignore this incredible scar, this incredible abuse that has happened. And over time, what happens is anytime you take something that's a terrible wound and you cover it up and hide it, it doesn't get better. It gets worse. It gets infected. And unfortunately, that's what happens time and time again. You know, it gets worse. It impacts all the other relationships. And you see this even here in the story with Tamar. Look at again verse 20. What happened to her at the end of verse 20? It says, so Tamar lived a desolate woman in her brother Absalom's house. So she kept her peace. She didn't bring an accusation. She protected the family. But as a result, it impacted her so that her whole life was defined by this abuse that she never was able to heal from. Why do we hide that? You know, as we think about that, and many, again, I know that we talked about last week that in this place, there are many, many that I know that are victims of abuse. You know, that it, again, you know, it's probably 40% or higher of women. And it's probably, if again, everything is told, it's probably around 20%, 15 to 20% of men. So if you're here, you're not alone. You know, there's many. And we hide it, I think in a large degree, sometimes it's fear. You know, fear of the abuser, the people in the family, the people in the job. And that's part of a fear that is added to, as we see here. You can't say that. You know, you can't bring it against that. We're fearful about what might happen if we talk. But another is that we're also dealing with issues of shame and of guilt. And so we hide it out of shame, embarrassment, and fear. And so that's what you see again here with Tamar. It wasn't only just because she's told, well, don't do this, don't bring this up against your brother, but you see this incredible shame that immediately she goes and she rips her dress in a story of shame. She lives in someone else's house because of her shame and as a desolate woman. You know, and the sad thing is that you can hear someone else's story. If you talk to someone else and you hear their story of how they were abused, how they were taken advantage of, you cry with them and you say, you know, you're a victim. And if they say, well, I feel, why would you feel guilty? No, you're a victim. You know, that's, you bear no guilt. You know, you're not shamed by this. You're not stained by it. That doesn't define you. And when you hear someone else, you say, you see it clearly. But if you're the one who's been victimized, you look at your own story and you cannot see that upon yourself. What happens when you are the one that's victimized, you feel this incredible shame. You feel this guilt. You feel that you've been scarred, that you've, you know, somehow been ruined. And you feel such shame over it, then out of fear, then we can't talk about it because we feel like, well, if I share that, people would reject me. They wouldn't know what to do with it. You know, one of the things, again, that another thing that frustrates me when you read the story is you look at King David's response. Here's not only the king, it's the father. This is Tamar's dad. And look at verse 21. It said that when he heard of all these things, he was very angry. He was angry and he didn't do anything. He didn't do anything to Amnon. He didn't do anything to help Tamar. In fact, what we see is that, again, she goes and lives with her brother, but there's nothing that her dad seems to do. And the fact is that there are many people here who have been victimized. And the sad thing is that when you look at it, there were people that should have protected you who didn't. There were people that you should have been able to go to that should have acted, but they didn't. Maybe they were angry, but they didn't do anything else. And again, the sad thing is I know some people, that's been the case even within the church, you know, that you've talked to people within the church and people, you know, they didn't help you. They weren't there for you. They weren't comfortable. They, you know, they told you even, I know people that have gone to churches and they say basically ignore it. And if that's the case, again, I want to be able to say, speaking from as a pastor, reflecting the heart of God, of our loving Father, I apologize if the church has done that. Because that's where the church has improperly reflected the heart of Jesus Christ, the heart of God the Father. And I apologize for us as a church when we have done it wrongly. What I want you to realize is that, no, God offers grace. He offers healing. There is no shame. There's no embarrassment. You know, you're a victim here. You're not guilty. You're not scarred. You're not stained. And he invites us to come and to bring our every concern. Look at it says in 1 Peter, we should cast our anxieties on him because he cares for you. We should be able to come to him and be open and honest because he loves you. He cares for you. And a hidden wound never gets better by hiding it. Jesus is the great physician. But as the great physician, again, as long as I had my wound all wrapped up in gauze and I didn't bring it to the doctor, it wasn't being treated. And it's only as I bring it before him and let him treat it, can he heal it. And when I bring it to him, what happens is there's incredible healing power of God's grace and his love and his redemption. But it means taking the risk to talk about it. And again, because, you know, God is only going to heal the things that we allow him to heal, that we actually bring to him, that we actually admit, that we talk to him about it. And what we need to do is that we need to realize that as we bring it before him, what he's going to do is that he's going to bring healing, and much of that is through truth. Because again, what happens is when we've been victimized, we often feel like, well, we're broken, we're worthless, we're, you know, God can't use us. Look at what a sample of what the truth is. You know, we need to expose the lie and we need to claim the truth. This is what God says about you. If you walk in Christ, if you have a relationship with him, it says, even as he chose us before the foundation of the world, that we should be holy and blameless before him. Number one, he chose you, that you are his chosen child, that he has searched after you and he has made you holy and blameless, that you're not scarred. That you're not polluted, that you're not someone that we're kind of ashamed of. No, that you are holy and blameless, and he predestined us for the adoption to himself as sons through Jesus Christ according to the purpose of his will. That he adopted you, that he embraces you, that he sees you as precious, that he sees you as his child, holy and blameless and pure before him. See, and part of that is learning to believe those things, learning to speak the truth about ourselves that God says. And one of the incredible things is it not only then washes us and gives us a new identity of ourselves, that is love, that is grace, can not only heal, but it says that it can redeem. And this is incredible because only the gospel can do that. What it means is that God has the power to be able to take the worst things that happen in our life, and when we bring it before him, he not only washes it, but he somehow works in it to bring something good. That he restores it so that it can we can use it to help other people, that he takes what we think is a weakness and a strength. One of my favorite verses, Ephesians 1:11. In him we have obtained an inheritance, having been predestined according to the purpose of him who works all things according to the counsel of his will. Now, do you see what that's saying? That he works all things according to the counsel of his will. That he is able to take everything that has happened to us. It's not that God is the source of our sin, the source of sin that has happened to us, the source of the abuse. God isn't the source of those things. But God's sovereignty is such that his power is so that he works in us so that all the things that have happened to us, the things that happened to us before we were believers, the things that happened to us when we had no thought of God, the things that other people have done to us, that God is able to work all things according to the counsel of his will, that he's able to take these things and redeem them so he's able to bring something good and glorious out of it. So that here's what is able to happen is that God is able to take our story of shame and by his grace, it becomes his story of glory. And we know what this looks like. We hear people all the time share these stories and testimonies of things that were terrible. And boy, man, I can't believe that. And we're going to hear some of it, you know, in a couple weeks where these two men come and share. What a terrible story. But they share their story and yet at the end say, man, what a great story of God's grace. Because God uses our, you know, he redeems it. So our story of shame, our story of brokenness becomes his story of grace. Another way of even using the whole idea of picture of wounds is, yeah, God heals us. And we say, yeah, but we're healed. And but I still bear scars, you know, all these things. Yeah, there are scars. And that's true. You know, that if you've experienced this kind of abuse, if you've experienced this kind of brokenness in life, yeah, there will be scars your whole life. But this is the incredible thing, is that God is able to take the scars that we have and somehow work in us so that what was our scar becomes now a mark of our beauty. And so when people look at us and they see here's the failure that we think is our scar, people look at us and say, "Poor, what a great story. That's actually a mark of their beauty. That's the mark of the uniqueness that God uses us." Only God can do that. And so are we willing to take the risk of saying, God, here is this wound that I need to expose to you because I need to be healed. I want not only be healed, but Father, I want you to restore me. I want you to redeem and use even for good that which I see now as brokenness. Well, that's the first thing that we tend to hide. The second one is that we go back to 2 Samuel, is that we see the second wound that we're tempted to hide and cover up is the problem of sin within our family. Or within the lives of others in our, you know, not only our life, but of others within that family as well. And so there's a danger of ignoring undealt with sin. And, you know, so we've seen in the last couple weeks, here you have this incredible, you know, David, this incredible king. And when you think about David, one of the things that you think about is this great warrior. I mean, here's a guy that had incredible courage, had incredible faith. You know, that he, this great warrior that everyone else, when they looked at the giant Goliath, everyone else was running away. And he said, you know what, God is able to beat this giant. And he steps out in the battlefield and he takes on the battles that everyone else avoided. Here's this incredible warrior. But the Bible shows that this great warrior, this great leader who took initiative in so many areas of life, couldn't stand up in his own home. And when faced with crisis and problems and threats in his own home, this great warrior that would step out in that battlefield ran away on this battlefield. And he failed to deal with issues. He failed to deal with conflict and sin within his own home. And it did incredible damage. What you see is this, it was a warrior who had the heart of a coward. He was a warrior on one battlefield, but he was a coward on another battlefield. And so look at even how this plays out. Let's go back to 1 Samuel 13. You know, that you hear that David, again, he hears about this, you know, the one son has raped, you know, the one daughter. And again, in verse 21, it says, when David heard all these things, he was very angry. He was mad. You know, he was mad, but he didn't do anything about it. And we can sit there and we can understand, yeah, it's hard to know what to do. What would you do? You know, do you do justice? Do you kill your son? But that's your son. And even if you discipline him, well, he's the crown prince. What do you do? Because if you expose this, what does that do to his credibility and possible leadership? I think a lot of it may have been that his guilt. He's looking at it, and he's still recovering from his own sin with Bathsheba, and he's sitting there saying, well, how do I stand up and declare what's right? How do I discipline my family when I know how guilty I myself am? But what happened is that you see him, for whatever reason, this great warrior in one context, suddenly is a wimp in another context, is unwilling to fight the fight. And not only did he ignore Amnon's sin, but we're told that he didn't take care of Tamar. That he left that back basically up to the brother. And not only that, but then you hear of this conflict. Look at verse 22. But Absalom spoke to Amnon neither good nor bad, for Absalom hated Amnon because he had violated his sister Tamar. So basically, in verse 23, it says it goes for 2 years. You have this incredible conflict in the family, and he knows that one of his third oldest son hates his oldest son. There's total resentment. They're not talking to each other, and he knows about it for 2 years, and he does nothing. He just lets it happen, because if you ignore it, of course, it's going to get better. You know, just wrap it with gauze, and of course, it's going to get better. But again, as we've seen, just like a physical wound, it never gets better by ignoring it. And so what happens? It doesn't get better. If we read the rest of chapter 13, we hear this, that Absalom allowed his anger to grow, and in time he planted his revenge. And he didn't show any anger explicitly, but it was all underneath. And after 2 years, he throws this whole thing, and this whole story, I'm going to throw this party, and he invites his dad, David, and David says, no, I'm not going to come. Well, send my brothers, and so he makes sure that he gets David involved in getting Amnon to this party. And we're told then that Absalom has this, great party. Now look at verse 13, verse 28. And Absalom commanded his servants, mark when Amnon's heart is merry with wine, and when I say to you, strike Amnon, then kill him. Do not fear, for I've commanded you, be courageous and valiant. So the servants of Absalom did to Amnon as Absalom had commanded, and all the king's sons arose, and they mounted his mule and fled. And so here he plans this, and he kills them. He kills this one brother because it didn't get better. It got worse. The infection grew. But even now, look at what he does. Verse 37. But Absalom fled and went to Talmai, the son of Helmed, king of Geshur. And David mourned for his son day after day. So Absalom fled and went to Geshur and was there for 3 years. Now, what happened? Absalom knows that he's guilty of premeditated murder. He's guilty. He can be tried. He can be put to death. So what he decides to do is to run away. He goes to hide at another kingdom. This is a guy that happens to be his maternal grandfather. And so he goes to hide there. Verse 39, and the spirit of the king longed to go out to Absalom because he was comforted about Amnon since he was dead. So he longed to go out to Absalom. He wanted to restore it. He wanted to bring some healing, but he didn't know what to do. And so what does he do? He does nothing. He doesn't try to bring healing. He doesn't confront it. He doesn't bring justice. He just, he just ignores it. And he says, okay, if you want to hide over there, well, that's the problem. That's okay. Because if we ignore it, if we wrap it with gauze, if we don't have to deal with it, well, that will make it better. And so what you have happen here is that he does nothing and it gets worse. I want to tell you, this is a huge problem. And I'm speak specifically, I think, to men here. The fact of the matter is that men, what you see here in David is something that is often a problem for men in our culture and in the church. A lot of times we can go out and we can learn what it means to lead and to take initiative in the workplace or in other parts in the culture, but then we come home and we become passive. We're lions out there and we're lambs here. Or sometimes you have men that are, so loving and so kind, and we try to be kind and loving. And what we can do is we can allow that kindness and that love to become an excuse for being passive and weak. We don't want to make anybody unhappy. We don't want to have conflict. And if we address an issue, if we actually have conflict, well, then people are going to be unhappy, and we want to be loving, so we'll just give in. But in reality, a lot of times that giving in is allowing sinful behavior to continue on without confronting it, and God has called us to lead and confront. Now, let me share how this impacts our lives in a very, very personal way. My maternal grandfather is the person I'm named after. It's Michael, and I'm proud to have that name. He's a wonderful man. I inherited a great deal from him. My hairline is one of the things, I'm not as happy about that, but I inherited a great deal as far as who he is, and I hope that I've taken his character. He's the kindest, most compassionate, great example of love, wonderful man. He's a wonderful man that had an incredible weakness. He totally failed like David did in taking leadership in his family. He's married to a little Italian 4'11", tiny little woman who totally ran the family and was abusive verbally, physically, emotionally. And that's what my mom grew up with, that she grew up in a very, very abusive home. And that's the reality. And it's like one of those family secrets that you don't talk about until, you know, you grow up and then you start to deal with it. And she was verbally, again, physically, emotionally abusive in every way. And here you have this most loving, compassionate man who stood quietly by and let it happen, would just walk out of the room and not be there because he didn't know how to deal with it. Now, I will tell you, looking back in hindsight, part of the reason that my grandmother was that way is that's what she was raised in. Her mother, likewise, was a domineering, controlling woman who was verbally, physically, and emotionally abusive to her. And so she grew up with that abuse. And my great-grandfather was a kind, loving man who allowed it to happen. And so she grew up as a victim of abuse who then became an abuser herself, which deals with the whole issue of generational sin, which we talked about last week. And only God's grace has the ability to break. But the fact of the matter is that you look at that and you say, my mom grew up in that. I praise God that by the gospel invaded her life and broke that generational pattern. But she grew up with a wonderful man. And again, I love my grandfather, a wonderful man. But he was weak, and he allowed abuse to happen in his family. And that's something that, you know, that as much as he was great in so many ways, the fact is he failed incredibly right there. And so you look at that and you say, what can we do? Well, how do we address it? How do we deal with this? And the fact of the matter is that, you know, if we confront it, there's a risk and we don't know what to do. But the fact of the matter is that God has called us to confront it. We're never called to allow sin to continue on. And the fact is that the Bible specifically for us as Christians gives us a model. It gives us an idea of what we're called to do. Now, this is especially true for those of us who have a relationship with Christ, and especially if any other people in your family have that relationship. It says that, you know, if something happens, we're supposed to address it. Matthew chapter 18, look what it says. If your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he listens to your brother, you've gained your brother. Now, this is not only your brother. If it's your wife, if it's your husband, if it's your child, if it's anybody, that the fact of the matter is that because these relationships are closer doesn't make it less so that we should confront issues. It makes it more so. So when we do that, we're called to go in to bring it. And said, what if they don't respond? Well, here's what the Bible says. This is the biblical parameters. If he does not listen, take one or two others along with you so that every charge may be established by the evidence of two or three witnesses. So if they don't listen, go to the church. You have the church. You have a relationships here. You have a support system. God has given it to you. Use it. And go, and so you go privately and find a few people that you know well, that you trust their wisdom, and you say, will you help me do that? And if they don't respond there, then it's going to say, okay, how do we as a church then help you? If he refuses to listen, you know, tell it to the, and whatever what that means basically is that as a church, it's then our responsibility to come alongside of you and to be involved and help you say, how can we resolve this? And you know what? There are many, many different issues that I believe right now that are going on in families here that need to be addressed. You know, some of that is abuse. You know, there are families, I know that there are verbal abuse, that there are emotional abuse, maybe physical abuse. That shouldn't be allowed. There's some that there's sexual sin that are going on. There's pornography, and you know that's happening. And so some that, you know, you're being pushed even to participate in things that you believe are wrong. You know that they're in inappropriate online relationships. There's all these things, and if that's going on in your family, what you've got to realize is that, no, God has called you to deal with it. And not only has he called you to deal with it, but he's given you a support system to help you. Now, sometimes you say, you know, somebody says, well, this is an issue. And the other person, well, no, it's not an issue. We don't need to go. We don't need to bring it to the church. This happens all the time. You know, somebody will say, oh, no, this is not an issue. It's not a sin. Here, let me give you a basic rule here. All right, if you are, especially within marriage, if you're married, if you've got a relationship and you say, okay, well, it's not an issue. And the other person says, well, it is. Well, here's the rule. If it's not an issue, I'll give you an example. I remember a family that I talked with, and the guy got into being a nudist, all right? And, you know, and so when he says, well, that's not an issue. And I said, okay, well, let's see if it's an issue. Here's a way to do it. If it's not an issue, then you would feel comfortable coming and talking to spiritual leadership about it because it's not a sin. And if you're not comfortable coming and talking to spiritual leadership about it, then deep down you know it's an issue. You have shame and you're trying to hide it. And so the fact of the matter is that if it's something that is being trying to be hidden, it's a wound, it's a scar that needs to be exposed and needs to be dealt with. Now, you look at that and you say, but that's scary. Well, you've got to realize that there's healing power of confession and forgiveness. Remember David, he had a wound that he didn't want to deal with, that he had hid for a long time. And what happened is that God sent someone to help him deal with it. And what did we read about David? If you remember back several weeks ago, we looked at Psalm 32 and what happened prior to that. What was he going through? Look at what he said. For when I kept silent, my bones wasted away through my groaning all the day long. For day and night, your hand was heavy upon me. My strength was dried up as the heat of summer. You know what he's saying? I put gauze on it, and it kept getting worse and worse and worse. But then finally, someone confronted me, and I acknowledged my sin to you, and I did not cover in my iniquity. And I said, I will confess my transgression to the Lord, and you forgave the iniquity of my sin. And what happened is he acknowledged it, and God healed it. But he did so through someone who had the courage to come and say, I will come and I will be a friend and I will confront. And a lot of times you say, well, they won't receive that. But look at what it says in Proverbs. Better is an open rebuke than hidden love. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. Profuse are the kisses of an enemy. Someone who always loves you and never confronts you, well, that's an enemy. The person that is a true friend is the one who is willing to speak truth. And the fact is that we have to be willing to bring truth, to bring healing. See, the third danger that he gets to is the danger of buried anger and unresolved conflict. And you see this, first of all, starting with the example of Absalom and Amnon. Here you have, you know, Absalom that is, you know, dealing with, you know, it's really repressed anger. You know, he sees his brother rape the sister and he does nothing. David does nothing. Nobody does anything, but he sits on it, and for 2 years he allows it to grow. And what happens? Does it get better? No. It grows and it becomes worse and worse and worse, ultimately leading to justification to murdering his brother. And what, you know, anger that we don't deal with will always get worse. Look what it says in Ephesians 4. Be angry and do not sin. Don't let the sun go down in your anger. Do not give the opportunity to the devil. Here's what it's saying, is that if we have anger we don't deal with, what we're doing is that it's an infection that is going to grow, and Satan's going to get in through that infection, and he's not only going to make it an anger problem, he's going to use it as an opportunity to give other temptation where suddenly you're justifying, you know, murder. Suddenly you're justifying adultery because of your anger toward your spouse. Suddenly you're justifying all kinds of things. We need to deal with it. And David, what we see here is not only need to deal with it, we need to deal with it fully. Because in the example here, you see not only the lack of dealing with it, but then you see David partially dealing with it. You have a partial forgiveness. In the first half of chapter 14, you know, you have David's general, Joab, makes up this story to get David to realize how he missed Absalom. And his hope was to try to bring Absalom back from exile. And one of the things that you see in the whole story, as you see, sometimes you have well-meaning friends give a spiritually sounding advice that's totally foolish. And it's because what he did here is he gave spiritual sounding advice that really wasn't resolving anything. So we pick it up in verse 21. Then the king said to Joab, behold, I grant this, go bring back the young man Absalom. And Joab fell on his face to the ground and paid homage and blessed the king. And Joab said, today your servant knows I have found favor in your sight, my lord the king, and that the king has granted the request of the servant. And Joab arose and went to Geshur and brought Absalom to Jerusalem. And the king said, let him dwell apart in his own house. He is not to come into my presence. So Absalom lived apart in his own house and did not come into the presence. Now here's what happened. David says, all right, I'll bring him back. I'll forgive him. He can come back, but I don't want to see him. Now does that sound like forgiveness? No. You see, true forgiveness is something that there's two aspects. We not only let go of all the punishment that's there, we let it alone. You know, we say, okay, what we want to do is we want to forgive and totally forgive, totally release. And what he has is, well, I'm going to let go part of the punishment, but part of the punishment is going to stay. And somebody said, you know, described it, what we often do is, you know, we bury the hatchet, but we leave the handle out for easy access when we need it, you know, and that's what we can do. And that's what you see here with David. His actions didn't restore the relationship. It just added resentment. Look at verse, starting in 28. So Absalom lived 2 years in Jerusalem without coming into the king's presence. And then Absalom sent for Joab to send him to the king, and Joab would not come to him. And he goes, you know, this whole thing. And basically what he does is he sets his field on fire to get his attention. And then he asks, you know, why did you even bring me here? You know, if you look at 32, Absalom asked Joab, behold, I sent word to you, come here that I may be sent you to the king to ask, why have I come from Geshur? It would be better for me to be there still. Now, therefore, let me go into the presence of the king, and if there is guilt in me, let him put me to death. Now, this isn't a warm father-son relationship. It's broken. And what you see is the problem that gets to the next thing. He sits there, you know, if I'm guilty, let him put me to death, which is implying, you know, I know he's not going to put me to death, so therefore declare me innocent, which he wasn't, which leads to the next problem. His next thing is he's forgive and forget. And I hear that all the time. You need to forgive and get. That's not biblical. It's what David does here, and it's destructive. It's deceptive. Verse 33, Joab went to the king and told him and summed in Absalom, and he came to the king and bowed himself on the face of the ground before the king, and the king kissed him. And it sounds wonderful, and it's loving and hugs, and there's one problem. They still haven't dealt with the issue. They haven't dealt with what Absalom did. It's like, let's just ignore it. Let's forget. Let's forgive and forget. We'll just bury it and pretend it didn't happen. And it has all the trappings of restoration of relationship. But here's the problem. Is what we've got to realize is that we cannot just forgive and forget. Forgiveness means that I acknowledge what was done that was wrong to me, that I acknowledge this was the price, you know, what it cost me, this is how it hurt me, and I'm asking you to acknowledge what you've done, and not until you acknowledge what you've done can I say, okay, now I can release it. See, if we just ignore it, we're not forgiving and forgetting. We're not bringing it out. Again, it's to use the imagery of a wound. You know, you can't heal the wound until you expose it. And it's not until both parties realize and acknowledge, this is what happened, this is how I've hurt you, I apologize. Not until that happens can it fully be forgiven. And this idea of forgive and forget means just kind of bury and ignore is really what it is. And that's what happened here. They just, you know, let's just bury and ignore it and pretend it didn't happen. But you know what? When you do that, it doesn't get better. It just becomes infected and it gets worse. And we see that play out in what we're going to see next week. And the whole picture next week is that Absalom eventually becomes so angry with his dad that he leads revolt against him. See, God calls us to instead to have true forgiveness. There's restorative and healing power of resolve, conflict, and forgiveness. And is it hard? Yes. Does it take a risk? Yes. Is it risky to bring an issue up and really deal with it? Yes, it is. I agree that. Could it go wrong? Yes, it could. What would have happened if David would have confronted Amnon, if he'd have confronted Absalom? I don't know. I don't know what would have happened. It would have been messy. It would have been hard. It would have been difficult. I don't know what would have happened, but I know what happened when he didn't do it. And it was disaster. And the same thing's true in our life. We might worry about what would happen if we do, and I don't know, and it is a risk, and it is hard, and it's painful. It's a lot harder to take that wound, the Band-Aid off, and to clean that wound. But you know what you do? It's hard in the short run, but it's healing in the long run. And there's power in forgiveness. Just as a closing illustration, let me use even the story, the people that are coming here in a couple weeks that are going to be speaking on that Friday night. Listen to this story because it's a powerful illustration of the power of true restoration and forgiveness. Okay, if we're not going to be able to hear that video sound, we'll share that with you next week. But let me just tell you basically what it is. It's, again, you have that black man there that was there. He had been set up illegally by a policeman that was trying to be able to, make his record look good. He needed more arrests, so he just found somebody, planted drugs on him, arrested him, sent him to prison. That white officer that did that eventually, that guy is, again, Jamel, it's in our bulletin there. It's, if you look at there, you know, Jamel McGee. And the white officer, Andrew Collins, he eventually was found out, sent to prison. And they both were released, and they just so both happened to end up at a place, a rehab place, where they were working together. And suddenly you have black and white. You have this guy that had set him up and all the resentment and all the anger and all the ability and potential for that to just blow up. But what happened is that both of them along the way had become Christians. And part of what happened is that they learned to live out what their faith meant, and they took this relationship, you know, this anger, this wound that could have totally destroyed both of them, this anger that could have destroyed that whatever relationship and every relationship that they had, that they allowed God to come and bring his healing power, his restorative power, not only to their individual wounds, but to that relationship. So that, so much so that they became friends and they're going around speaking and sharing their story together as great friends who are now taking their story of shame and celebrating it as God's story of grace. So God has the power to heal anything. He does. Just a closing question. You know, what wounds in your life or in your family need to be addressed and healed? Because the fact of the matter is that there are many of us that deep down, we know that we have things that we have, that, you know, that we're wrapping up with gauze, and some that we've hid for 20, 30 years. We're hiding and we don't want to deal with. The other ones that are going on now, and there are dysfunctions that are happening, and we hide them well, and we look good when we come to church, but we know what's wrong. And the fact is that God calls us to be a people of grace, but a people of truth, and in that truth, to speak truth to the crises, to the sin, in such a way that it brings God's grace and healing power and love. And is there risk in dealing with it? Yes, there is. Is it going to be painful in the short run? Yes, it will be. It was a whole lot more painful getting that thing unwrapped and going to the doctor than it was to continue to hide it. But you know what? In the short run, it's painful, but in the long run, it's healing. And it's amazing the healing power that God could do, that even as you see in the story of these two men, that he has the ability to literally take our story of shame and turn it into not only something that is healed, but it becomes his story of glory. Are you willing to believe that he could do that with you, with your wound, with your life? I want to let you know, as a church, we're here to help you, because God has called us to walk with you through that. And we have people that are willing to be there with you no matter what that road brings.
Thanks for watching. If you have any questions about what we talked about, Jesus Christ, or church, feel free to reach out to us on Facebook, Instagram, or by email. The links are in the description.